Excellent. With that, I'll call the second case this morning, A24-0613. I believe I'm pronouncing this correctly, but the parties can correct me. Pamela Hike versus Kevin Hike. Is that correct? Good morning to both counsel. As I would first like to check if you have your screen in gallery mode, you should be able to see the time clock. Can you just verify for me that you can both see this time clock? Excellent. As I'm sure you're both aware, you'll each have 15 minutes for your argument this morning. And counsel for appellant, you will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. We are making only an audio record of today's hearing. So if you would please identify yourself and your client before you begin your argument, the court would very much appreciate it. With that, counsel for appellant, you may begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Benjamin Casa, appearing on behalf of Kevin Hike, who is in the gallery. May it please the court and opposing counsel, the appellant is here before this panel today to ask for a reverse and remand on the issues pertaining to parenting time and child support in this matter. There have been four general allegations of error against the district court when it comes to child support. The first error includes not including the vision insurance for the child to the tune of $14 per month, which has an impact on the medical support obligation for the child. When the panel takes a look at the child support worksheet that is attached to the district court's order, it will note that the district court appropriately put down $284 for Mr. Hike's portion of coverage for Astrid on his medical insurance, but for reasons unknown to both my client and I, we don't know why the vision insurance wasn't included in that analysis, and it should have been, which has an impact on the medical support. So we believe that that is error number one in this particular instance.
How much of an impact does that have on the award? And I ask because we do have case law about not reversing for de minimis calculations. And so what's the dollar amount that we're talking about in terms of the impact here?
I can't give you a specific dollar amount, Judge Larson. The reason I can't do that is I simply did not run that. But I would have to imagine at $14.50 per month, and when I take a look at the parties' respective incomes, which the appellant doesn't dispute, we're probably talking about a few dollars per month at absolute most. And I should be more specific than that. I do believe it would be not more than $3 per month would be the actual impact. So with regard to the child care support, however, that's a slightly bigger issue than the medical support aspect. The party's affidavits in this instance, Ms. Hike, the respondent, she indicated that the child was no longer participating in child care, despite the assertion of appellant that he had been previously paying $145 per month as he was ordered. So given that the child was not enrolled in child care as of the time of December 1st, which was right before the district court heard the motion, as well as the time of the motion hearing, there should have been no award of child care support in this particular instance. So that certainly does make a difference of $145 per month, and we believe that that should be remanded to the district court to at least tidy up that particular error. And I don't think there's any dispute by the parties factually amongst their affidavit that the child is not enrolled. And I would even take that a step further that Ms. Hike has indicated that she believes because of the child's ADHD, autism, and gender dysphoria issues that she cannot be placed into any type of a child care. Moving along to the biggest issue in this case are the issues of parenting.
So what did the district court ultimately decide with respect to your client's obligations for child care costs going forward? Can you refresh my recollection?
The district court decided that Mr. Hike should be paying $145 per month to Mrs. Hike as a part of his child support obligation, and that was included in the child support calculator.
Reading between the lines, you would agree the district court thinks that this child should have childcare should have access to being placed in some kind of childcare. I just want to make sure that I'm understanding the conclusions as well as the facts preceding the hearing with respect to whether this child is going to be in receiving childcare outside of the home in the future.
Well, certainly the district court could be inferring that. I'll grant you that. However, in this instance, I think with the way that the district court styled its particular findings in this case, I think that your question, Your Honor, leads to my broader argument about relying or reciting the parties' affidavits. And I think that we can't tell what it is the district court was attempting to do with child care support. It very well could have been the conclusion that, well, maybe Astrid should be in this particular program. But child care support tends to rely on established patterns, not just, hey, this person might go in the future. And based upon that potential to go into child care, we're going to make some type of an award. There was no showing by Ms. Hike that she was continuing to incur child care costs that needed to be reimbursed by Mr. Hike. So does that answer your question?
So Judge Braffel may have a follow-up.
Yeah, I have a quick follow-up, and maybe it's my misunderstanding of the record. I thought that there was some evidence offered by mother that indicated that the reason the child wasn't in child care currently was because she was unable to pay for the entire cost. And so she was looking for that contribution from father. And maybe I have that wrong. So
I don't think you're entirely off base, Judge Bradfold. And the reason that I think that is because there were competing affidavits indicating whether or not the child ought to be placed in the child care. The child had been in the past, absolutely. And the district court was, I think, in a bit of a bind, saying that, well, look, the child is taking and attending school at the same place that mother is employed. So if mother's not working at school, school's not going on, arguably the child has care in this particular instance. So I think that's how I would sort this particular. Yes, maybe mother wants it in the future, but she's going to have to go get it in this particular instance and show that that need for childcare is in fact tethered back to her need for employment or for education. In this instance.
So really, counsel, when was childcare terminated?
Childcare was
time, right? The child was in childcare.
Child was in childcare up through, it sounded like, December 1st or November 30th, and it had been terminated just in the weeks leading up to the motion hearing that took place in December of 2023. So, now coming back to the issue of parenting time, this is where there's the greatest amount of consternation on behalf of appellant, and he's going primarily to Dean versus Pelton, which is a child support case from 1989. But I think he really thought that the court took and just recited statement after statement after statement, and this permeates everything that goes on in this particular case when it comes to parenting time as well as child support. And examples were raised in the brief whereby the district court will say a statement such as mother's affidavit says this, father's affidavit says this, or even Ms. Rabine, the therapist, she says this. It's difficult to determine what precisely is the district court relying on in this particular case. And the district court had an obligation underneath Dean versus Pelton to say that, no, this is my finding. Yes, the parties might have said these other statements over here, but this is the district court is my finding. And that leads to the even bigger issue that the analysis of the best interest factors in this case, it came up short because the court eliminated a whole four of the best interest factors, some of which were relevant to this particular case. While within the seven that the district court did take a look at, it suggested that three of them did in fact favor Mr. Hike, but the court within the seven that it did analyze also said that you know what, we think that the schedule needs to take and be the first and foremost, because the district court appears to have struggled with father's description of his parenting time as a meteorologist.
Counsel, we have a series of non-precedential cases where we have said that when you're modifying parenting time, we've had cases where the district court didn't analyze any of the best interest factors, and we've affirmed on the ground that there isn't any requirement that you have to analyze any specific best interest factors when you're doing a modification of parenting time. Is there a reason why we shouldn't find those cases persuasive?
Well, first and foremost, they are non-precedential, but secondly, there's two things that are going on here, because the district court did make its election to use the best interest statute, and I think had to go through all those. But more importantly, even when it reached the end of the analysis, and I know this is something that my client feels very strongly about, he feels that the right of first refusal that was applied by the district court somehow leaves him short on parenting time, and in fact comes up to a restriction in this particular case, because while the district court awarded initially 6 overnights to mother, followed by 3 overnights to father, if father is somehow losing an overnight every single one of his parenting time sessions, that's going to push him down closer to 20% in this particular case. And I think that the court was trying to find a way to do something, but its particular approach in this case just didn't work. But to come back to your question, Judge Larson, about, well, we have all these non-precedential cases, true, but I think that that is overridden by the fact that the court chose to engage in the best interest analysis here and ultimately placed weight on a therapist who gave a generalized, not specific suggestion to a child with disabilities. And I think that the court needed to have more information on that particular analysis rather than a 1+ page letter from a therapist who just said, here's the diagnoses and here's generalized suggestions. I think that more was owed to Mr. Hike in that particular sense.
Counsel, I mean, you're correct that non-precedential cases are not binding on us. They're only for persuasive value, but the plain language of 518.17 states that the court must consider and evaluate all relevant factors. In other words, under its plain meaning, the court doesn't have to analyze factors that are not relevant. And I mean, I think that, as Judge Larson points out, case law bears that out. So can you cite any
catch
case
in
law
this instance?
I'm sorry. Can you cite to any case law that requires a district court to evaluate each and every single factor, even if it's not relevant?
Off the top of my head, no, Judge Reyes. But here's what I would posit in response to that, which is that in this particular case, Ms. Hike made a counterclaim to modify custody, which rested on supposedly Mr. Hike's mental condition. Now, factor 5, we talk about the physical, mental, and chemical health needs of the parties, and it was a pull or tenet argument of Mr. Hike that he was in a unique position to empathize and understand the parenting needs of Astrid better because of his condition. The district court did not weigh that, and we do suggest that failure to do that is error in this case. You could also make a claim for underneath prong 8, the well-being and development of the child changes to home, school, and community. Astrid has, since the initial order in this case, or the decree, she's gone from having no care, she's been placed into school, she's had multiple moves. There was no analysis of this as well as to how a change in the parenting time schedule was going to take and impact Astrid as far as changes in this case on parenting time. So we do think that Mr. Hike does believe that this warrants a reverse and remand for the district court to give further consideration. And I'm fine waiving my final minute, Your Honors.
Are there any other questions from the panel? Seeing none, thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honors. Gerald Wallace appearing on behalf of respondent Pamela Hike. It's the respondent's position that the findings of fact were sufficient, that there was no abuse of discretion, and that the ruling of the district court is entirely appropriate and within the bounds of case law. In reviewing the appellant's arguments, I believe Your Honors sort of encapsulated some of the issues that respondent has with appellant's positions on these issues, on the issue of pairing time, which is the big driver and large issue for the appellant. The district court correctly analyzed the relevant factors. The other factors that were raised by the appellant in oral argument today are not relevant to the issues in this particular case. He cites to factor eight, there would not be any changes to the home in this particular instance, nor to the community, nor to the school. The change in after school care is, in the mind of the respondent, not encapsulated in those particular factors. And frankly, wasn't something that was cited by either the respondent or the appellant in their motions before the district court. What was cited was, you know, the factors that were cited by the district court in its order. Appellant also raises this contention that his own diagnoses allow him to better relate to his child with the same diagnoses rather than the respondent. The issue here is that question may or may not be true. There's no other than the appellant's offered opinion, there is no other factual support for that, I guess, allegation would be the right way to put it. There's no documentary support from any sort of therapist or journal or any sort of supporting documentation that this is the case. There's affidavit allegations that would seem to indicate that the opposite is true. But either way, Your Honors, that's not enough to say that the district court abused its discretion. On the issue of child support, the vision insurance dollar amount is certainly a de minimis finding. It sounded like Mr. Casa indicated it would be about $3 a month times 12 months is $36 a year. That certainly seems to be de minimis. On the issue of child care and participating in child care, if the child were in child care, then that would be a payment that would need to be made. At this point in time, Your Honors, we're almost a year on from this motion hearing. And if there is issues with child support, they're probably best readdressed at the district court if there's been sufficient changes in findings that meet the 20% or $75 threshold under the statute. The factual findings of the district court, as the appellate court well knows, are something that Your Honors are not going to disturb unless it's a tremendous abuse of, unless it's an abuse of discretion. And there simply is not that abuse in this particular case. So, Your Honors.
So with regards to the child support issue, my understanding of appellant's argument is that because the child was not in child care at the time the worksheet was filled out, that it was not correct to put the $145 on it. But it does seem to me that appellant is conceding that going forward, it seems like the district court was indicating this child care support or whatever programming child was in before this dispute about the child care support came up between the parties, that should proceed going forward. Do we have any good case law for how we deal with sort of that glitch in time, if you will, between this was happening, then it wasn't happening, now the district court is ordering that it should happen, and how that should be dealt with in these child support worksheets.
Sorry, Your Honor, I just want to make sure I understand the question. You're talking about the gap in time between, let's say, a child is in child care, they're removed from child care, and then they're placed back into child care. How should the Court of Appeals address that situation, correct?
Yeah, and I think here the district court, I mean, I would read the district court as finding potentially that the reason child was removed from child care was because mom couldn't afford it when dad didn't want to contribute.
Yes.
So what we have is child was in child care. At the time of this hearing, child was not in child care. It seems like the district court was saying, going forward, we want child to be in these programs based on father being ordered to pay the $145. What is your best case for how, when we're filling out these worksheets, that gap in time should be dealt with by the district court? Or do we have any case law that gives district courts guidance about how they should handle that?
I'm not aware of any specific case law. I mean, I guess in my mind, if I were, I think this is going to answer the question, Your Honor, and sorry if it doesn't. If I were the judge deciding the case, I would sort of put in some sort of triggering language that would state in the order, this would be, you know, this obligation would start now and it would cease if the child isn't doing X, but if Y resumes, then child support would be this amount. That would seem to me to be a logical case. And that would certainly be sufficient for, say, child support authority doing child support collection and administering a court order. I think that would be something that a county could administer. In this case, it's private exchanges, to my knowledge, certainly at the point in time of that order. And it would seem to me that if the child is not in child care, then that payment shouldn't be made. If that payment were being made, and I have no knowledge one way or the other, that's an issue for the parties to resolve outside of this courtroom, Your Honor. I hope that helps.
With respect to the vision insurance, my understanding is that and you can correct me if there's better evidence in the record, but it looks to me like the district court is getting the medical insurance information the same place that you would locate the vision insurance. And so is there a difference in the quality of the evidentiary support for the medical insurance costs versus the vision insurance costs? Is my question in response to your argument about the district court, because of the quality of the evidence, could disregard vision versus the medical care?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that the evidence submitted doesn't satisfy that the vision insurance cost is solely for the party's child. The evidence submitted on the vision insurance cost indicates that it's a blanket payment, and there's sort of no way to differentiate between coverage for Mr. Hike and the child and just Mr. Hike. And so in that particular case, if it's put into the calculator, then it's something that when it's all balanced out, my client would be partially paying for Mr. Hike's insurance, which is not the point of child support in general, or insurance, or child insurance support, so to speak. The point of that is to make sure that the parties are sharing the costs of the party's child's insurance between themselves. And so, Your Honors, with
the client doesn't dispute that he is paying the vision insurance for the child, right?
No, Your Honor, not at all. What we're saying is that the premium cost, you can't break it down. There's no individualization of the premium cost. So it doesn't say that Astrid costs $1, Kevin costs $2. That's what I'm saying, Your Honor. Not that he's not. He, as far as I know, he's paying it and continues to pay it. I'm simply saying that the premium he's paying can't be shown in a way to calculate just for the cost of the child, and as a result, it shouldn't be included in the calculation. I mean, Your Honors, we're in support of the district court's order, in this particular case. The findings of fact are sufficient. I don't think a court generates a 20-page order without carefully analyzing the positions of both parties and reaching a conclusion that it feels is in the best interest of the child. The court was very clear with the parties that essentially, when analyzing this, I don't have to take into account your positions on schedules. I can draft the schedule based on the evidence you provide me and provide what I believe is in the child's best interest. And the court did that. And the court looked at both Mr. Hike's work schedules and his ability to be available, as well as Ms. Hike's schedules and her ability to be available, and determined that the 3-6 rotating schedule was in the best interest of the child. And there's sufficient evidence presented by both parties to support that particular schedule being in the child's best interest. And there's certainly no abuse of discretion by the district court in making that finding. So, Your Honors, with that being said, if there aren't further questions, I yield my time. I believe the district court's order is sufficient and not an abuse of discretion. Thank you.
Any further questions from the panel?
No, counsel, I'd just ask you to respond, if you would, to the argument I heard from appellant's counsel. He described the parenting time schedule as including a sort of right of first refusal provision, and I guess I wasn't thinking of it along those lines, but I would like to hear your comments on that.
Mr. Wallace, did you hear Judge Bradfield's question?
I did. Oh.
I just wanted to make sure that we didn't have a system.
No, there wasn't. I'm struggling to find the portion of the order where there is the first refusal being implemented in some way, shape, or form. It looks like it's being struck, I think, in order one, paren B. Three nights in a row without needing to offer the child back to petitioner pursuant to the right of first refusal. So to a certain degree, what I think the district court is doing is accounting for the previous schedule in the party's divorce decree that addressed the appellant's work schedule, which is very complicated with the rotating three shifts and the sort of demands of forced overtime and things of that nature that led to the undefined schedule in the first place. And this was the district court's decision here sort of was intending to address, I think, the appellant's concerns that he wouldn't be getting the parenting time he should be getting. I think what Mr. Costa was arguing essentially was that this schedule would result in him sort of losing an overnight. And I think that the intention here was to address that concern, but still leave that first refusal language in place should it be necessary because of the schedule of the appellant, as well as the developmental needs and frankly, the mental health and special needs of the child sort of indicate that long-term periods of non-parental care are not really an option. And so, Your Honors, I think that that's where the district court is at, but I don't see putting that in or taking that out as being something that would be an abuse of discretion. The district court carefully analyzed everything, read everything clearly, and provided a thorough order analyzing, as Judge Reyes said, all of the relevant factors. And so, Your Honors, we're just asking that the order as it stands be sustained. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right. There's two items to address on rebuttal. The first one is coming back to the issue of medical support. Paragraph 56 of the appellant's initial affidavit, which was filed November 23rd of 2023, said in bright line that these are the coverages that are attributable to Astrid only. So I think that the district court, when it took and referenced that at paragraph 84 of the order, made the correct finding, but again, like, for whatever reasons, chose to exclude the vision insurance or not add it into the health insurance.
And is that the same place where the district court was getting the information about the medical insurance?
Yes, that is the exact same paragraph, even between appellant's affidavit, paragraph 56, and the district court order, paragraph 84. And I believe you can even take a look back at paragraph 83 of the district court's order to see where it pulled that information. With regard to the right of first refusal, that is at the district court's order of paragraph 64B, and it's got Roman numeral paragraphs 5 through 7, the right of first refusal. And that's where I put out there that my client feels as though that is some form of a restriction on him, because it has the ability in a month to push him underneath 20%, and he doesn't get to make that time up. And so that's where that argument comes from, that the district court should not have included, because it unnecessarily restricts when it made no finding of endangerment or problems for the appellant, and it even rebuffed the respondent's motion for a change of custody. So my client does feel that he should be able to have that particular time with his child. So, and with that, I have nothing further by way of rebuttal for the court, unless there are further questions.
Seeing none.